The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to make my country again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
All right, you're welcome along to the Football Show. We'll keep you up to date with all the latest scores as the show goes on. But I'm delighted to be joined in studio by the man of the match from last Sunday's FAI Cup final, Roberto Lopez of Shamrock Rovers. How are you?
I'm good.
Very good, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it's been a great few days now, obviously celebrating the Cup final. And yeah, I'm just kind of recovering and still taking it all in at the moment.
Recovering from the match or recovering from the celebrations?
Recovering from the match, obviously. We went to extra time and it took a big toll on the body, and obviously there was some great celebrations after the game and the day after and the day after that. Like, so it had
been a while since Shamrock Rovers had won a cup. It was incredible just how long, considering the storied history of the club. And one way or another, it was going to be a momentous day, whether it was a first cup win in 32 years for Rovers or whether it was going to be Dundalk winning the treble. And then it was such a dramatic day. Did that add to the sense of just absolute exhaustion at the full-time whistle? Not even the fact that it went extra time penalties, but the way you probably had in your head you had that cup final won, I presume.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It's the emotion that you go through on the day. Obviously, it's the build-up towards them. Like, we got up for me breakfast and like, I feel the butterfly starting then, so to go through that, going through the warm-up, taking in the atmosphere.
Did you stay at home the night before, or did you go to a hotel?
We stayed in Carton House, yeah. So we woke up there and went for our breakfast in the hotel. You could feel the butterfly starting then. I mean, you're travelling to the stadium on the bus, and then you see the atmosphere when you get in there and train the national anthem. And then you actually playing the game, obviously you're so focused and then in the game and trying to do your job right and trying to win the game for your team. And then the jubilation of scoring a last-minute goal, only to be cancelled out by a last-second goal. It's a roller coaster, and then to go through the extra time and then the penalties, it does take a toll on your body, but I'm just so happy that we came out on the right side of it.
My sense in the stadium when Michael Duffy scored that goal with literally the last kick of the game was that everybody, almost the Dundalk fans as well, were just shell-shocked, because it felt as though the game was done. It felt as though the penalty was going to be the match winner. For you as a player standing inches away from it happening, what were your thoughts as you saw it nestle in the back of the net?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Like, obviously, like you said, we've got the last minute penalty. You think that would be enough, but like, you know, in this game, you can't switch off. And a player like Michael Duffy with so much quality, you give him half a sniff in the game and he'll punish you. And he did. Like, and it was literally just a moment of brilliance from him, because the ball could have dropped anywhere in the box. He was on it like a light, and it's a really great finish. But I think when the game finished, we kind of spoke amongst ourselves. I just remember Joey saying, "Look, lads, we're all shocked. Let's not like dress it up. Like, it happened. Let's go on with it. The next 5-10 minutes are important." And I thought we managed the first half extra time really well, because it was a real hammer blow after you think the Jubilation were going to win the first cup in 32 years, and then for that to happen. So I thought we managed the first half extra time really well, dug in there, and then started to build ourselves up again. And the time the penalties came around, I thought we were a lot more confident than we were probably finishing again.
Would that be normal that Joey O'Brien would be the one who'd stand up in moments of difficulty and say the right thing at the right time?
Yeah, that's just Joey down to a T. He's seen it all. He's been there, done that, and he's just got really great experience. And he wasn't the only one who said words, because there's a few leaders in the team. But throughout the season, yeah, any hard times they've been through, Joey always has something to say that's constructive and that would help us, because like I say, he's been through it and he's just fantastic to have something like that in the team.
Are you the sort of player who can enjoy a day like that? That mid-match, you can almost look around and take in the surroundings and appreciate where you've got to in your career, or does it all pass in the blur?
It all passed in the blur. Yeah, I couldn't enjoy it. I had to watch the game back yesterday because I didn't know how we played. I wasn't sure if we played well or not. It was just because you're so involved and then you're so concentrated on your job. And even looking back in the videos of the march and the atmosphere in the stadium, it was brilliant, because as you say, you see it when you come in there, but you kind of block it out as soon as the whistle blows, because you know you need to be concentrating fully here.
Was that the first time you played at the Aviva?
Yeah, it's the first time I played the Aviva, and it was incredible. And you don't realise how big the pitch is until you step foot on it, because obviously it looks big on the TV, but then you get down there on pitch level and it's massive.
But how do you prepare yourself for that then?
He tried to do everything like that you would do in a normal match day, so you don't want to change too much. So like even that week up to train, it was the exact same, where we'd have our heavy days and light days, our days off. We tried to keep everything the same, keep the same routine. My match day routine was pretty similar in terms of what time I go for breakfast, what time I ate at, and just me pre-match preparation. So you try to keep everything the same and obviously try and play a normal game, and happened.
You hear of managers sometimes for these big occasions that they rehearse absolutely everything down to the two teams lining up, and somebody will play the role of the imaginary president 2 days in advance so that everybody can get themselves mentally prepared for what it'll be like for that long build-up, because it is a longer build-up to kick off, even been out on the pitch for probably 10-12 minutes rather than just getting straight into it. Had you done some work around that?
Yeah, I think what we done and what was really important was saying the week before, the week of the cup final, we actually went to the Aviva Stadium on Thursday just to kind of see the dressing room and see the pitch and just kind of take it all in, so it wouldn't be a shock to us when we got there in the day. That was really beneficial for us. And again, that was just, it was about keeping everything the same in terms of our routine and obviously not trying to get caught up in the occasion of it and focus on the match. And I think all the tactics for that really paid off and it worked.
Yeah, I think the general view would have been that Shamrock Rovers were deserved winners, that they were the better team for the vast majority of the game and controlled the game. Jack Byrne had a lot of great moments and probably created the most interesting moments in the game. When you watched it back, did you think, you know what, on cup final day we delivered, we did what we wanted to do?
Yeah, definitely. As I say, when I was playing the game, I didn't know how we were playing, because you're just so in focus on the individual battles going all over the park and obviously just trying to help your teammates show. But when I watched it back, it was actually a really enjoyable game, and I hope people in the stadium and the neutrals thought that as well. I really enjoyed watching the game back. I mean, we did play a lot better than I thought we did, and we had a fair few chances as well. It could have been one or two up in the first half. I think Green had a great chance off Jack Bourne's ball as well. Like, so yeah, I was very pleased with the performance, and like you said, I think we were deserved winners in the end.
You mentioned that the pitch at the Aviva is quite a bit bigger than probably what you're used to out in Tala. How did that work as a centre half? Did it change the way you had to play?
It took me a bit longer to get up to the halfway line, I suppose, and keeping the high line. But I think it was the same for both teams. So if we found it hard, I'm sure Dundalk found it hard. And it's just about managing it on the day. And luckily, we have a great centre half in Lee on one side, Joey on the other side, and Big Al behind us. So between the four of us, we've been able to manage the back line and obviously communicate to the rest of the teammates.
You got the Man of the Match award, and people have been talking about you all season, I think, as to how good you've been at the heart of that Shamrock Rovers defence. What is your background? Like, the obvious thing I'm sure that's brought up all the time is Roberto Lopez isn't a very Irish name. I'm wary of saying that in a modern Ireland, yeah, where we're going to have an awful lot of people with Dublin accents that don't have names that we would associate with traditional Dublin people. But what's your background?
Yeah, no, my father's from Cape Verde Islands, as I think a lot of people have got to know the last few weeks, and my mum is Irish. We grew up in Crumlin. I live in Crumlin all my life. And yeah, I started playing football with Lord Celtic. That was my first club, and left them, I think, when I was 13 and joined Home Farm. Played with them for 3 years, and then my final year of school, boy, I was on to Belvedere, and then obviously played for Bowles for a good number of years before moving to Rovers, and yeah, here I am now.
Yeah, the move from Bowles to Rovers, controversial one at the best of times.
Yeah, I think...
Is that something you still hear about?
Not so much anymore, because I think there's a few players that have moved between the clubs since, like, but whenever someone moves from either Bowes to Rovers or Rovers to Bowes, it's always controversial. You're always going to get a bit of stick, and you'd expect nothing else because it's a massive rivalry in the country. Like, so yeah, it got a bit of stick at the time. I don't think anyone's too bothered with it now, like, because it's how just players have moved in between.
And Bowles used to always beat you for a good while as well until the last time.
Yeah,
so
exactly, yes.
They didn't mind that much.
Yeah, exactly. So bragging rights might change now, because we got the better of them in the last two games. Like, so next season will be interesting to see what response you get.
And what was it like growing up in Dublin with the name Roberto Lopez? Did everyone just accept it for what it was?
Yeah, obviously you get questions. See, nobody calls me Roberto, so that's kind of great as well. Like, everyone calls me Pico. And Martin's question is, where does Pico come from?
Where does Pico come from?
That's my nickname. Obviously, right. My dad gave me that when I was younger. I couldn't tell you what it means, but everyone calls me Pico. My family calls me Pico, teachers, friends. Everyone used to call me Pico. So that obviously started the conversation of, oh yeah, who gave me that? And obviously my dad, and dad's from Cape Verde Island. So that's where I was standing from, telling the story.
The Cape Verde Islands, as you say, people I think have become aware of it because there was actually, I think, five senior internationals playing for Shamrock Rovers, players who played at a senior international level, and you were one of them because you're now playing for the Cape Verde Islands.
Yeah.
Was that something because of your heritage with your dad, you were always very aware of as an option?
I wouldn't say I was aware of it as an option. I think when I was with Bowles at the time, Aim Ben Mahan got called up into the Tunisia squad, and I was kind of joking, oh, I can't wait for my call up to the Cape Verde squad. And I kind of looked into it a little bit there, but never really pursued with any real intent. And then I remember getting a message on LinkedIn, believe it or not, to say that I connected with the manager, and I looked at the profile, his Cape Verde manager, and his history and all that. And I got a message just in Portuguese, which I thought was like a welcome message or spam, so I just took notice of it. And that was this time maybe last year, probably October last year.
Right.
And a few weeks ago then, a few weeks before the squad was announced, he wrote to me again in English to see if I thought about the last message, and I was like, well, what's going on here? So I translated it, and turns out they were looking at getting new people in the squad, and they were asking would I be interested in declaring. So I went back with my tail between my legs, apologised, and goes, look, I'm really sorry, I don't understand Portuguese. I just translated the message there. I'd love to be involved if it's not too late. And lucky enough, I wasn't too late, and the ball got rolling from there. I sent all the documentation that I needed, and lucky enough, I was picked in the squad, and I got a great experience playing against Togo and against Marseille, and it was brilliant.
What sort of level are Cape Verde at?
Very good. I have to say, the quality there, like given the players who were all over Europe and all over the world, it was really high standard. And even the games, two games were fantastic to play in. It was very like a European game. So it was very tough, very high quality, but it was just great to be a part of it.
Yeah. Had they been to see you play?
I'm not too sure. I think they seen videos.
Okay.
Yeah, there's plenty of videos. And the goalkeeper plays for AEL Limassol, and we played at Pollen Limassol as well, so
yeah.
I'm sure there was some reports being transferred between each other.
And what was the reaction after you made your debut?
It was crazy, because obviously it was a bit daunting going in to the group at first, because everyone speaks Creole and I didn't always spoke English. But once we started training, it was grand, like football is its own language. And then the match day itself, obviously a bit nervous, I was wanted to do well. After the game, it just all hit me. I was like, jeez, I'm about to make my international debut. And I had everyone text me, all the family text me, mum and dad, so proud. Like, so it was brilliant, and it was great to share that joy with them.
Yeah, and I guess you don't want to stop there either, because Cape Verde play in the, well, will be attempting to qualify for the African Cup of Nations, playing Cameroon later this month.
Yeah, they're playing Cameroon and Mozambique. Yeah, so yeah, hopefully.
When do you find out if you're in?
I'm not too sure. I think the squad was announced today. Like, I'm not in the squad, so I wish them all the best. Like,
yeah.
And hopefully down the road, like
the call will come again.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm thrilled at my experience that I had. Like, it was unbelievable.
Yeah. An international manager on LinkedIn is something quite unusual.
Yeah, that's why I didn't expect not the message at first, because I didn't know if it was just a welcome message or a bit of spam, because you say it's very unheard of.
What are the ambitions then? Because the way of the League of Ireland is, even though as much as it's improving, even the conversations around Jack Byrne are going back across to England again. Do you think you can fulfil your ambitions at Shamrock Rovers, or is part of everybody almost in every League of Ireland squad thinking, you know what, if I can get over to England, get the chance over there, I'll take it with both hands?
Yeah, well, at the moment I'm fully focused on Shamrock Rovers, and after winning the FAI Cup, we've set our sights on the league, and obviously getting closer to Dundalk, and that's been a big ambition of mine for years, to win the league in the League of Ireland. And as I say, I love the league, I love the energy, I love the intensity, I love just the backing it gets from the fans, and so I'm just looking forward to next season.
Yeah, Stephen Bradley was making the point straight afterwards that you need to prove to yourselves, you need to prove to everybody you can win these trophies, you need to actually go and do it. And Shamrock Rovers have done that, Dundalk have done it consistently through the years. There probably is going to be quite a bit of pressure on next season now, because of the resources that Shamrock Rovers have, because of the fan base that's there, the history. There'll be an expectation that it won't be an 11-point gap. I think it was it up in 17 points when Dundalk actually won the league and were crowned league champions. And you'd expect the club are going to try and kick on again in terms of the transfer market, that you'll be having going into next season very much with title ambitions.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the way it has to be. As I say, we've made a statement now about getting our first cup and probably beating Dundalk in a big game, like, for a long time in a while. But like, that's the pressure you expect to be at a big club by Shamrock Rovers, and it's a pressure that we've been putting on ourselves as well, because we want to win it as players first and foremost, win a league. I haven't won a league yet, so it's a big ambition of mine, like I said. And for the fans as well, it'd be great just to continue to grow and close the gap in Dundalk and hopefully overtake them.
What's Stephen Bradley's philosophy when you're in training? Is there a certain brand of football that he's very keen to ram home constantly?
Yeah, he wants us to play football. He has great visions and he's a very intelligent man. The way he sees the game and the way he interprets it to every player, it's fantastic, and he's a great man to work under. He'll make you a better player. But yeah, he tries us to play the ball down on the ground and just to trust each other, because he's brought some great players to the club and we need to use them and use our strengths.
You're obviously training every day with Jack Byrne, who's been in and around the Ireland senior squad and has made his international debut. And listen, I think everyone's very aware of his technical abilities, and there's very few players anywhere who demand the ball and can do so much with the ball. From being around him every day, just how good is he?
He's incredible. Incredible. Like, his ability is, I don't think I've seen him better. He sees things that no one else sees, and then he pulls them off as well, which is incredible. But even off the pitch, Jack is just a massive influence in the dressing room. He's the most liveliest man I've ever met. So much energy. He could come in with half a head in him, and he's still the loudest man in the dressing room. And it's great for morale and obviously team building and bonding. And he's doing his business on the pitch as well. He's not just kind of here for the laugh. He's went from the pitch training. He's fully committed, fully focused. And like you said, it's stuff he produces in matches. We're seeing it week in, week out in training, and it's unbelievable.
So I do wonder about that dynamic. It was noticeable when he came on against Bulgaria, straight away shouting at the centre-backs to give him the ball and not to have been going long. And being like that, and that, like, that's his way, and that's the way he wants to be. He always wants to get in the football. When he came back in and he arrived at Shamrock Rovers for the first time, and he's like that with you as centre-backs and your more experienced players, is that an easy transition? Does it take a bit of time to get used to that sort of personality?
I suppose, a little bit. Just obviously getting to know each other's ability, but very early on you're seeing what Jack had, like, so you'd want to give him the ball. You want your best players on the ball at the end of the day. So if Jack's coming demanding the ball, you're going to give it to him, because it'll make me look like a better player and he'll probably deliver the pass that'll win us the game. Like, so it didn't take too hard to get used to, as I say. He showed what he could do in training early doors, and we're trying to get him on the ball as much as we can in games all the time.
Shamrock Rovers, obviously, it feels as though it's very much heading places. Dermot Desmond, it's been announced in recent weeks, is going to make an investment. There's a very strong academy there. Like, Tallaght Stadium is probably the best stadium that any club has in the League of Ireland in terms of facilities. Do you get that buzz as a group as well, that this is a club going places?
Yeah, definitely. And since I came in, I've been here 3 years now, and the strides that the club has made going forward, it's incredible. Like, even look at the first team squad, the academy teams, and as you say, the facilities. Like, it's gone from strength to strength. I think it was very important to win that on Sunday as well, just to kind of say, because trophies are important as part of that development. But I think if you're at Rovers at the moment, you've got to be looking forward to what's ahead, like, and obviously kicking on and all the news and all the positivity that's coming out of the club, looking forward to it.
When you're in that dressing room, and you mentioned Joey O'Brien earlier, like, you almost need to remind yourself when you're watching Joey O'Brien, it's not that long ago he was playing at the very highest level and not getting the odd game. Like, he had many seasons at West Ham where he was very much first choice centre half. Do you tap into that? Have you spoken to him about that and what you need to play at that level?
Yeah, like, it's crazy. Like, you just kind of ask him about his stories, like who was the best player you played with, who this fell in the team. Like, when I went away, we played Marseille, and Poya was playing for Marseille, and I was back talking to Joey. He's like, "Oh, how's Poya?" and all that. Like, and he'd tell stories about him and training. Like, but you don't forget, because Joey shows his quality day in, day out, and over this season he's been top class for us, so consistent. And I don't think you can forget that he played that level, because you see the quality performance he puts in week in, week out this year. You can see why he's played at that level. Like, so it's incredible to have him there.
What do you think you need then over the close season and heading into pre-season to be able to bridge that gap to Dundalk? Because with the European money, they're not going to stand still either. They're going to go out and they're going to try and reinforce, and they're going to have the ability to go and spend some money. When you're looking at the group, when you're talking, I don't know if you plan an end-of-season debrief so that you can probably kick on for the start of next season. What are the areas where you really feel you just didn't get there this season that saw Dundalk win the league?
Look, obviously that's kind of important. The manager, the plan ahead, like me and myself, I think there was a few games, obviously the games against Dundalk and games against Combos, that we didn't really pick up points in, as well as probably maybe a draw against Derry, and I think it was Sligo down as well. They probably points this season where we really should have been picking up points, and we're probably looking at in the games where we could have done better, and then where we could have won the game and probably should have took points back with us.
Is that a mental thing? When, particularly the fact that Dundalk are a very good team, obviously, but the bohemian side of things, do you look at it and think you put too much stock almost in those games?
No, because some of the performance, I thought we performed really well, and it was just a matter of when we're on top, it's scoring the goal and finding a way to win, as I say. And that's us as a group of players, we need to find ways to win if we want to be successful going forward. And the most important thing as well, actually, is probably keeping the good squad together and then maybe adding one or two just to keep the quality up and the competition there. And you look at the likes of Neil Ferrugia, who's coming back from injury and only played a handful of games. He looks like a real talent. Like, so I'm looking forward to seeing Neil with a full pre-season under him and really attack the start of the season.
Do you get much time off now ahead of pre-season? Because it is a long winter break, it always feels, in the League of Ireland.
Yeah, no, I'd say we'd be off for like a month or so, and then we'd normally in the gym for the off-season, working with Darren Dillon, the strength and conditioning coach, and do some good stuff there. And then I think, like most clubs, we'll be back on the pitch in January, and the hard work starts again.
When do the celebrations finish?
I don't know if they ever finish.
They go all the way to Christmas, I'd say, anyways.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully they get
Where have
Christmas
you been over the last few days?
We were up in the Abbey Court and the Terranure Inn on Monday, just obviously bring the cup round to the fans, and we got a great turnout, to be fair, and it was brilliant. Then we went on into Temple Bar, and that was that for the night.
How much of an awareness is there amongst the players of, I guess, the building, the brand of the club in South Dublin? It's a club based in Tallaght, but its history is all over Dublin, but also particularly all over South Dublin. Like, you're talking about going to places like Terranure that aren't that far from Tallaght, but trying to tap into that sort of crowd to increase the attendances.
Yeah, I think if you didn't have a sense beforehand, you definitely did after Monday. As I say, going to the Aberley and meeting all the fans coming up to you, shaking their hands, thanking you so much. It's incredible. And you're hearing their stories of how long they've waited, and from when the times in Milltown they used to go watch games and all that. And then the same in Terranure again, meeting all fans. And it's just brilliant hearing their stories and how long they've supported Rovers and where they've been, where they travelled, and how they were longing for this cup. Like, so it was fantastic to kind of give that back to them as well, because they've waited so long and they're so loyal to the club.
Yeah, Roberto, it's been brilliant to have you in the studio. Enjoy the celebrations.
Thanks very much, Nathan.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
All right, welcome back to the football show. You were hearing from the man of the match in the FAI Cup final, Roberto Lopez, there. He has been replaced in studio by Dan McDonnell.
It's a weak substitution, to be honest.
I didn't want to say.
Yeah. He's got only one more international cap than me, though.
Oof, harsh.
Or two. He played once behind closed doors.
He played in Marseille behind closed doors and not in the squad for the upcoming African Cup of Nations qualifiers.
Yeah,
but no, you're okay, Dan. It's good to have you here.
Yeah,
I appreciate you coming in. Did you enjoy the cup final?
I think I did. I mean, I think sometimes, like, if you're there and you're sort of an advocate for the league as such, that you tend to sometimes worry too much about, oh, is this a good game? Is this back? You know, and like sort of just take it on its merits, to quote a man who would sometimes sit in this seat as well. That it was. There was a degree of drama in the game. I think that the quality of the game was quite good in terms of the way the teams like tried to play, but it wasn't a thrilling game either, you know. So it had like lulls, but I sort of spoke to some people who were there, wouldn't necessarily be massive regulars, who just were impressed that the sides were trying to play. So while it wasn't a thrill a minute, it wasn't like hoofing the ball into touch either, you know, in those sort of patches. And in fact, at times it was just two good sides probably cancelling each other out a bit.
There's definitely a sense, I felt as well after the game, of like the League of Ireland can be in danger of sort of eating itself in a way of, as you say, over obsessing with, was it a good game? This was our one day in the spotlight. Oh, was there enough people there? Yeah. Was the quality on show enough? Did Jack Byrne really show everybody what the technical talent of the league is? And actually, it was a good game. Wasn't the most dramatic, but it was actually an incredibly memorable cup final because of what happened at the end.
If you obsessed over every game in every level to the same degree, like, I don't think it was bad. I don't think it was a classic. I think it was somewhere in the middle, and there was storylines out of it. I guess even with a media head on or whatever, like, there was storylines out of the game. You know, there was stuff that happened. There was drama. You know, the quality of the penalties actually from Rovers was very good. You know, like, really, you know, I mean, then you see it's like, yeah, these are good players here. And I think with a view to next year, it probably was, as much as people from Dundalk, which is my neck of the woods, will disagree, I think probably in terms of being the better story for the league, I think that story was the better one. Just in the sense that there's been Dundalk dominance for a while, so you have to believe that there's going to be a rivalry next year, and Rovers winning the cup will probably propel them towards that. Whereas if they'd lost it, I just think it would have been a massive, massive psychological blow for them. And he, I mean, you had Roberto Lopez on, and you know, you can see the emotion around the week for a lot of people involved with the club, that it should probably make them a better force next year. Whereas if they'd lost, I think, geez, I think the grouping would have been hard.
Mm. So some of the stories of today: the Republic of Ireland squad has been confirmed for both the friendly against New Zealand, which is on this night next week, and then of course the all-important Euro 2020 qualifier against Denmark on Monday week. It seems along expected lines, Troy Parrott and Aaron Connolly are included. Lee O'Connor, who's suspended for the 21s, is going to go in with the senior squad for the friendly match.
Mm.
So he's the young Celtic right back. What is the thinking behind having him involved? Is it that Matt Doherty's an injury doubt? Because the talk and the speculation earlier in the week was that Sean Gannon might actually get a call up.
Yeah, but Sean Gannon, I see, is a doubt for the Linfield and Dock game tomorrow. Sean Gannon, as far as I know, injured himself in the warm-up on Sunday, and possibly might explain why he wasn't at his best. And yeah, like a couple of Dundalk players weren't, but so yeah, it's possible. I'm sure that Gannon was in the consideration, but Lee O'Connor is also suspended for the 21s match. Maybe, you know, was that apparent to people completely in terms of their planning, and it suddenly it popped up as an opportunity to play, you know, to bring O'Connor in for the full week, whereas obviously Gannon wouldn't be able to join up until Tuesday because Dundalk are playing on Monday night in that game, and he'd need Tuesday off, so actually he'd have no time to repair it if recover, even if he is indeed fit at all, although for him it might be once in a lifetime. So I don't know what his take would be. The surprise one for me would be Ryan Manning not being in the squad, purely because so much fuss had been made about him being in the provisional squad, including by the FAI themselves. Now, I know that they have to drum up interest and get discussions, and I can't really complain about them, you know, providing weekly updates of where management are going. I think we'd complain if they weren't doing that, but there were comments from Mick McCarthy that suggested that Parrott and Manning would be around the New Zealand game. That I think McCarthy said at one point that Manning, who's playing left full for QPR this season, would be someone who could benefit from that New Zealand match. But that's not come to pass. And
Enda Stevens is the only out and out left back.
Derek Williams would be the alternative. And Williams, we were told in Tbilisi, was quite close when we had that game where Doherty played left back because Stevens was suspended. I think
Williams came on in that game.
Yeah, he came on very late, and even in training there was a suggestion he was very close to even playing, so he will be the backup. And I suppose James McLean could obviously drop back as well. So Manning, yeah, slightly surprised. Beyond that, not really. Kieran Westwood not involved is probably the end, realistically, of him.
Is that potentially interesting? If Darren Randolph doesn't recover in time?
My reading of it would be that if they thought Randolph was a worry, you know, would they name a squad without Westwood? That's just a hunch, you know, that they mustn't be that concerned. And even similarly with Doherty, would they have included Cyrus Christie if they were really concerned? Mm. He hasn't made the squad at all.
A couple of interesting returns in that Robbie Brady is back and Kieran Clark is back.
Yeah, Brady probably has the most to gain. Let's, you know, just trying to do a piece for tomorrow. And in many respects, like, you're trying to say, well, what's the relevance of the New Zealand game for Denmark? And I think Brady is the one player who can probably play in the New Zealand game and play himself into the starting 11 for Denmark. I think the others, with David McGoldrick being back, say, it's not as if Troy Parrott, for example, is going to do something that makes him start against Denmark. It's not realistic. I think, however, that right-sided midfield, that right-sided position, because McCarthy has indicated he'll return to his sort of preferred system, that right-sided position is one that's probably up for grabs. And I think Brady is somebody who can bring something to the mix. So, yeah, Kieran Clark, good for him to be back in the squad. You'd still think it'd be Duffy and Egan, though, wouldn't you? If all went well over the next sort of week or so in terms of fitness. But he's in a reasonable position. He's probably in a better place than Kevin Long right now. And the other one, of course, is James McCarthy not being in the squad, which I know he was an off the ball over the weekend, and probably wouldn't be a massive surprise to people who heard that interview.
No, he was probed by Stephen Doyle.
Probed. Yeah.
Probed. And probed and probed and probed.
But off the ball, a probe. In fairness, Steve O's gets more out of his Sundays than your chats with Seamus Coleman.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
Fireside chat with Nathan and Coleman.
Get out of here.
Just, you know.
Bloody hell.
Steve on a Sunday bringing home the stories.
Wow.
Agenda setting commentary and coverage.
Screw you. Screw you, Dan.
You've done some fine stuff on Sundays over here. You're getting angry complaints from Donegal people over the years for your vendetta against Seamus Coleman.
Well, exactly.
And it was aimed at someone else.
I know. You know, at least we're getting these interviews down. But anyways, the FAI say personal reasons. Like, I hope personal reasons is a terrible line to use. Like, this, what I took from his interview with Stephen was that, well, there's no point me going over with Ireland for 10 days. I'm unlikely to play, and actually the best thing for me is to stay here, train really well, and put myself in a position. Now, is that personal reasons?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point. And I think if you hadn't heard his interview on Sunday, you know, you might be looking at this going, oh, what's going on?
He turned his back on the country.
Yeah, but I think it is, in many respects, it's probably consistent enough with a lot of what we've heard over the last couple of months that I don't think Mick McCarthy was going to play him on the strength of, you know, how little football he's played for Palace. Again, presuming that Glenn Whelan is fine, I know he's an injury doubt. If you presume that he's fine, that Hendrick and Harrigan and Alan Brown are fine, he's not going to play him. So is it more beneficial to let him have a rehab week at Palace or whatever it might be, you know, and be ready for after the break, than it will be to come over and try and force it against New Zealand and then not play against Denmark or whatever? I mean, the phrasing of it probably leaves it open to some kind of interpretation, but I think it's just not realistic to believe that he was going to play, if he was sort of like James McLean style, you know, storming across the Atlantic at the first, you know, the Irish Sea, sorry, not the Atlantic.
Where are these guys coming from?
Robbie Keane is the only one who needs to storm across the Atlantic, and even then,
Joe Lipiera.
Has he ever been here? I don't even know. Has he ever been?
That's a great question.
Has Joe Lipiera ever been to Ireland?
I mean, have we had a senior international who's never been in the country?
I'd imagine he would be the only one if that was the case. Have we had a senior international, more or less, who's never played for Ireland in this country? I assume there's plenty of one-cap wonders who've won their cap away from home.
There must be players who went on those US tours.
Who only played in America. Mm. Oh, yeah, there's quite a few. Peter Murphy and a couple of those. Alan Bennett, 2007. There will be, to be fair. But, you know, it wouldn't be a massively, massively common thing in recent times. If McCarthy was in that zone where he was desperate to come over, if he was maybe a slightly different personality coming off the back of a slightly different period in his club career, you know, you would raise more questions about what's going on here. But there's been a real softly approach with his international career over the last while. It was a massive source of controversy, I guess, while he was at Everton, and maybe when he's trying to establish himself at Crystal Palace, you can perhaps understand why he wouldn't want to be coming over if he's not going to play, and it might serve him better for the longer run to spend time in this club. But I mean, that's what he'll have to speak about it again in more detail in McCarthy to clarify what exactly happened. But I'd just be surprised if he was in his plans to play, and I'd imagine that was driving it more than anything.
There is obviously quite a few injury doubts. You touched on some of them there, so we'll have to wait and see till they come in after the weekend as to maybe what Mick McCarthy is thinking. You were suggesting there he might return to his preferred shape.
He's said as much that he definitely will be going to a flat back four anyway.
Does he, and trying to think back historically to his previous time in charge, like, Ireland didn't play well in those two matches last time out. Does he react? Mm-hmm. Or does he just go with the tried and tested again and hope to God that this time they can deliver? Or are there enough options there that he can go, you know what, we need something pretty different this time around. Too many of you have underperformed too often.
I think there's going to be a lot of emphasis on David McGoldrick and his importance. And I think, you know, I think there probably will be a view that if you look back to probably the better performances this year, I mean, the last game in the Aviva against Switzerland, actually Ireland didn't play well at all, but McGoldrick did get the late goal, and the better performances earlier in the year, you know, Denmark away, was a professional enough job. I've heard a few criticisms of that performance. I thought that was okay, actually, to be honest, Denmark away, but particularly Georgia at home, when that was a real strong front foot display at the Aviva Stadium. This is how Ireland should play at home. And it was McGoldrick's ability to hold the ball up and bring others into the game that allowed Hendrick and Harrigan to press on. And you had that sort of overall aggressive, good Irish display. And I think with McGoldrick back, there might be a belief that this will lead to a sort of a domino effect elsewhere, whereas last month there was a sense, I mean, Collins was up front on his own in Georgia. It's not his game, really. Collins needs, like, crosses into the area to feed off and stuff. And I mean, he was getting on the ball 35, 40 yards from goal. That's not him. And I mean, there are questions about players in the team, you know, in the midfield department and so on. But I just wonder, will McGoldrick's return be the catalyst for McCarthy to look at something very similar in terms of setup and personnel, even to the Georgia game at home earlier this year, and probably Switzerland to a lesser degree?
All right, lots more to come on that over the next week or so. Stoke have gone after Michael O'Neill And it looks as though they've got Michael O'Neill.
Yeah, this is a surprise in terms of the timing of it, because, I mean, Michael O'Neill, I think I was looking at the Belfast Telegraph today, was only speaking today about their big doubleheader against Holland and Germany, which is coming up. It doesn't look like they're going to miss out on that, you know, and there's no shame in it at all. They really need to do a job on the Dutch at home and hope for sort of an incredible series of results. But beyond that, I mean, they are heading into that playoff cycle next March, realistically, that Ireland will be in if they don't beat Denmark. And he's there a long time. He had been given a lot of control within the IFA. He's been given the best contract they've ever given a manager, and they've almost done that to fend off interest. But like, at the same time, you know, he's been mentioned in relation to clubs in the past, and West Brom was one in the summer, which you thought would have been attractive. And when a push came to shove, either the offers didn't materialise, or it just, you know, it wasn't a sense that he was on the top of everyone's shortlist for jobs that were coming up now, unlike other managers. Like, you know, Chris Hughton was mentioned for that job. Other people are mentioned for that job. And maybe selfishly, now is the time for him to go and do it. Like Stoke, they are bottom. They're in a relegation battle. It's probably a tough job, but they are a club with money in the Championship.
Well, that's it. They're still very much part of the parachute payments and will be for another couple of seasons.
100%. So if he can just keep them up, which you would think, you know, he's got plenty of time to do that. He's probably at a club then where he's got a bit of credit in the bank, a bit of money in the bank, a good sized Championship club, and that is his window into the English game. He doesn't have, like, maybe, I think his reputation in England should be bigger for what he's done with Northern Ireland, but it's just a natural product of just, you know, other people are more fashionable, or deemed to be more fashionable at a period in time. I think he's an excellent manager.
It really does feel like
I think there's every chance he'll do well.
Perfect timing in that, much like with the Republic of Ireland job, Northern Ireland qualifying for a World Cup for them is almost an impossibility. They would have to overachieve to such an extent to qualify for a World Cup. So it's all about the European Championship. And they're heading into a playoff cycle where I think they're almost certainly going to be away from home in the first leg of their playoff, potentially a difficult opponent. He's basically committing to hanging on for another year in the hope of winning two games.
Yeah.
And if you don't, you've got 6 months of nothingness.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think you're completely right about the World Cup campaign. I mean, his time to leave is in the next year. I just think, you know, down here, if we were in a bit, I mean, we've had a courtship between a manager and Stoke in very recent memory.
And a similar name.
And it was in January. And at that point, even that was taken badly. So he's got a lot of credit in the bank for Northern Ireland, but it's still an emotive one. You know, a month out from, or a couple of weeks out from big games, and I don't know, obviously it's an evolving story, and I think more is going to come out across the next 24 hours. Could it suddenly be arranged that he still managed for those two games in a couple of weeks' time?
Well, you'd imagine, you know, I guess, do the Irish Football Association want him to stay on? Because,
I mean, Stoke only have one game in the next,
and it is only 10 days away.
Yeah, Stoke
that they
only have one
Dutch
game. So, it's not, you know, I know you wanted to get under the table, you could feel under the table and meet the players and do all of that, but you think if
Leave
you want
Rory
to
lap in charge,
if you want them badly enough, you can probably, you know, I think they play Barnsley at the weekend, which is a big game, but you know, how realistic is it for him at this stage to be in situ for that? So maybe he can stay for those games and he goes afterwards. That'd probably be the happiest resolution for everyone.
People might look at it and go, Stoke are bottom of the Championship, but they clearly feel that they're at a much higher level. Initially, when Nathan Jones was sacked, they went after Alec Neil, who's the Preston manager, who are top of the Championship, absolutely flying. But it clearly shows that they feel that they're not going to be staying in this position.
No, I mean, Mick McCarthy was floated around, but you see, the thing about Mick McCarthy is because he's such a CV at Championship level that he will get Championship offers, whereas Michael Neil just doesn't have that on his CV in England, that he probably, if that's where his ambitions lie, he probably does just have to get on that ladder eventually. And I think that they are a club again with money, and that matters. It's not just any old Championship job. Like, it's not, you know, it's not just, you know, going to Barnsley, say, or one of the sort of less moneyed Championship clubs. This is a club that really has been a Premier League club for most of the last decade. So it is a great opportunity for a manager if he can get it right, although recent history at Stoke suggests that a lot of managers have failed to get it right there.
He's still only 50 as well, Michael O'Neill.
But he's never managed in England, you see. So, like, he has to take that chance soon.
And going back to the time he was in charge of Shamrock Rovers and style of football, and this is maybe at Stoke, they're not overly bothered right now about style of football, and they put up with Tony Pulis football for long enough. But at Northern Ireland, he's obviously incredibly well organised and speaks brilliantly about how he goes about organising them. Like, they're not that exciting a team to watch. They play an okay brand of football, but it's just a structure, basically.
They're very organised.
When he was with Shamrock Rovers, Was it a similar style of football from what you remember?
Well, like, they weren't. His Shamrock Rovers side weren't spoken about in the same way that Stephen Kenny's Dundalk side were, in terms of their approach to the game. That's not to say they weren't a good footballing side, but in terms of how they approached Europe, he was the master of a good game plan, you know, and. There would have been players in that team such as Gary McCabe and I suppose Ronan Finn, a younger Ronan Finn, and you know, he would have had players who would have been quite creative, but I think a lot of what he had was a degree of organisation about a team that actually did very well away from home in Europe, possibly found it a bit harder at home in Europe when you maybe have to come out and play a bit more, but you know, went away to proper opposition and equipped themselves very well. So I think, you know, like, he hasn't been associated with sides that play thrilling football, but that Northern Ireland team, you've watched them in recent years, they have a good solid base, but they sort of have a proper go as well, you know. And again, it's actually
put them under pressure,
but it's actually some of the away displays that spring to mind, like the World Cup playoff against Switzerland where they lost at home, and then away from home they were, you know, they really gave it a bash. So you know, working with the personnel that's there with them at Stoke, I mean, they still have recruited heavily enough. They were poor on Monday against West Brom, but I can see why the potential. He would look at the squad and probably have been told about money in January if they're in trouble.
He's a typical Stoke manager in a way, in that you look at his results with Northern Ireland and what he's transformed them into. Even this campaign, they've beaten the teams they were expected to beat. So the way it worked out, their first four games were against Belarus and Estonia, and they won all of them. And then they went up against Germany and the Netherlands and made life incredibly difficult for them.
That's sort of
what Stoke do.
Yeah, although Stoke have become...
What Stoke did.
The rainy Tuesday night and Stoke thing has sort of changed. Like, they've been a flakier outfit in recent years with different types of managers. They probably lost a bit of that Stoke identity by trying to evolve. And Mark Hughes then, you know, like that was the stepping stone.
Try to play a bit of football.
But I think if he, in the short term, can just get them beating the teams they should beat... You know, doing that part of the bargain, then he'll be fine. And then maybe over time build a bit of a plan, because I mean, the Championship is a mad division. He might only get one crack at it properly. But then if he does this job well, he's into a world where he never leaves that zone. And that's probably why he has to take it.
All right. Our football coverage brought to you in association with Paddy Power. For more information on responsible gambling, visit dunlewy.net. We'll take a quick break.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
You're welcome back to Thursday's football show. We have a double header of live Premier League action, as always, this coming Sunday. Starting at Old Trafford, Manchester United against Brighton. Rob Daly and Brian Kerr will be at that one from 2 o'clock. And then myself and Stephen Kelly will be at Anfield for Liverpool against Manchester City.
Not a bad Sunday.
Tasty game. I'm looking forward to this.
I can sense it. I mean, I can sense real enthusiasm in your, even just how you've introduced it.
It's always a bloody good game. In fact, the best Premier League games I've ever seen have been between Liverpool and Manchester City. Best games I've been to. I think the game I was at last January where City beat them was the best Premier League game I've ever seen live.
Really? Yeah.
It was obviously the year before was the 4-3 at Anfield, which was just unbelievably good entertainment and how good they were in an attacking sense. But you definitely got a sense watching them at the Etihad last January that these were the two best teams in Europe. Like, the speed the game was played at, and for the players to be able to execute what they wanted to execute under such pressure, both sides pressing as high as they could. Like, there wasn't a split second on the ball, and still they're carving out opportunities. They're doing all the right things at all the right times. Yeah, it was sort of breathtaking to go, wow, actually, for once, maybe the Premier League is all it says it is.
The gold standard. Yeah, it's hard to believe that they're going to have that type of, you know, the old cliched cup final stalemate type game that happens.
I mean, well, somebody did this time last year when they met at Anfield. It was 0-0.
I was just going to say, yeah.
It was rubbish.
Yeah, it can happen then. But you just feel at the moment, like, there's enough vulnerabilities with both to sort of make you believe that it's going to be an entertaining game, if you get me. You know, it's like, you maybe, like, you want it to be a high standard, but you need sort of some kinks there just to sort of get that early goal or something. Like, you know, look at last Saturday, for example. And I mean, last Saturday was great, but at the same time, last Saturday, they were both sloppy as well. Like, they were sloppy in a way that really, it was their brilliance that dug them out of a hole. Or, I mean, okay, you know, perseverance maybe rather than brilliance, but there's a brilliance in that. But look, neither of them are completely firing. Even Man City during the week against Atlanta, you know, they had sort of some choppy moments.
It feels a bit like with City, it's all or nothing at the moment.
Yeah.
That when it clicks, it all just flows beautifully. But if it's a bit tough, yeah.
I sort of find myself fancying them. I think with the situation in the league being what it is, like, this is it's a big game for both, but their need is... If you think that Liverpool are going to keep churning out the wins as they are, it's hard to believe they're going to drop too many points. As much as the December, the World Club Cup, and just that period, you can see why you can get a bit sticky for them. But it's hard to believe they're going to drop too many silly points. So when you play them, you sort of have to take the chance, you know?
Yeah. And it'll be fascinating to see what type of game it is, because having seen quite a bit of Liverpool over the last sort of 5-6 weeks, all the matches have a similar pattern, which is Liverpool have just got the opposition pinned back for the entire game. Even the match against Tottenham, a good chunk of the game against Manchester United, playing all the game inside the opposition half. You can't see that happening against Manchester City unless City think, you know what, actually, we're perfectly happy for them to do that, and we rely on the pace of Raheem Sterling. And we know that actually, whereas the other teams don't have the quality to break that down, just keep giving them the ball back.
Yeah.
Actually, when we win it back, we do have the quality to get at them.
Yeah, just soak it up a bit and then try and hit them.
Almost a typical away performance that you would expect from most teams.
Well, actually, that game last year, that was the missed penalty, of course, with Mahrez late. There was an element of that to that game. The City, I remember, sort of stepped it up a bit later on.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's sort of amazing how the season went. Would the season have gone completely dramatically differently if City had, as in, would they have taken control earlier if they'd won that match? It's a good way of looking at it. I just think they, like, now, I don't think Jurgen Klopp is ever going to adopt the Mick McCarthy style, but the old classic, if you offered him a point now, would he take it? I'd say, like, they'd probably take, if you could say parity, you know, in terms of where things are on the table now going into...
I think both of them would take a point right now.
You think?
Because
yeah.
City have so many injuries at the moment.
No, that's true.
And it's a game they just, as you say, they just can't afford to lose.
The last one before the break, or a brief break, so it might get one or two bodies back. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Like,
yeah.
Keep it at 6 points, and Guardiola knows that they need to go on a run of 10, 12 matches straight winning. And then you're probably in a position where you're quite close to Liverpool, if not ahead of them.
So by next time around, you have to... Look, they have to beat Liverpool in one of the games this year. And you think that it's mad to say that now when there's so many games to go. But I think the standard that the both teams are at are such that if City want to make up a six-point gap, realistically, they're going to have to take 4 points from the two matches.
Because the difference between this time, between now and this time last year, is probably that actually City look the more likely to drop points.
Yeah, they've been flaky.
Over the next while. You just don't see City right now going on that sort of 10-game winning streak.
But which is why, in a way, I think then this, well, for them, with all the weaknesses that you talk about and the injuries, but this is a game, it's you still have that feeling that when both play to their best, that City might just be that bit better. Now, maybe injuries and unavailability could prevent them from playing to that level. But you sort of just think when they're playing against Liverpool, this is the best chance to hurt them. And can that sort of rouse them to, like, a champion's performance, to a champion's display? But it's all set up to be a fascinating game.
Yeah, it would be, you feel, because of the international break as well, it would be a champion's victory because it's going to linger for Liverpool.
Yeah.
It's going to be
points.
A lot of time. It's There's no chance to bounce back straight away.
Yeah, and it's a three-point gap. And it's almost like, you redraw things and you kick off into the season again, you know?
I'm excited about it now, Dan.
You were excited when you started. Just talking about it is just... I wouldn't like to be sitting next to you on a flight over on Sunday. I'd say you'd be... salivating
about the possibilities. If you are, don't talk to me.
No,
you'll just be... like my private time on the plane.
You'll be quietly drooling on the plane. Not for the first time, I'd say.
Jeez, Dan, you're going in two-footed tonight, aren't you?
Not really. It's just...
I'm going to save myself for Saturday afternoon when we're back together again.
Oh, you're coming in this Saturday. Actually, last Saturday was good. Probably our best one of the season. But listen, it'll be good to have you back.
Well, that's all I heard. But anyways, yeah. Thanks for coming in. It's been great to have you, Dan.
Thank you. That is
pretty much our lot for this evening. Before we go, I can reveal that Donna Brennan is the winner of tonight's competition. Congrats, Donna. You've bagged yourself a pair of tickets to the Motorsport Show, which is happening at the RDS on November 23rd and 24th. You're also in the draw for a pair of two-day grandstand tickets for the 2020 London E-Prix with flights and accommodation in a four-star hotel. We are back tomorrow night on the radio from 7 with Friday Night Racing. It is Friday tomorrow? Yes.
It is
Thursday.
Yes.
Tomorrow is Friday. I'm going to be back tomorrow morning at 7:30. alongside Adrian Barry for OTB AM.
You're going to be talking about this game again, aren't you?
Quite possibly. I'm just going to repeat the same stuff. Certainly not. Brand new material coming your way.
Fresh insights.
Half seven tomorrow morning. Lots of great guests lined up as well, Dan, but I just can't reveal
them. No, you wouldn't want to.
Right now. We're streaming live across our social channels on OTB Sports Radio as well. That is us done for now, though. Dan is going to get a beating once we go off air. Tom Dunn is up next. Good luck.
With guilt later, I-